morning, everybody, although it's still light outside. Welcome to Take Two Radio. I'm Pam, your host. And like I told everybody yesterday, joining me today is my wonderful friend and co-host, David. Hello, David.
Hi, Pam. How are you doing this evening?
Oh, you sound cheerful.
Yeah. I'm looking at a nice sunny day out there myself.
Yeah, well, it's been so cold here that I cannot even begin to believe that it's August. You know, normally we've got the 90-plus degrees and the humidity is rather high. And, I mean, the evenings have been getting down to, like, the 40s and 50s. It's just unreal. Summer is almost over, and it doesn't feel like we've even begun it.
I know it. It is unreal. It's just waiting. Oh, we have a call.
Yeah. Why don't you sing for our people, and I'll check the call.
Yeah.
Hold on.
Okay. Right.
John, is that you? Hello.
Hold on, everybody. We'll be with you shortly.
Should I put a recording on? It's not done yet, so.
Not yet, everybody.
No, not yet. But you know who it is? The person we discussed earlier.
Yes, I know.
The man with the videos.
Mm-hmm. I thought he'd come.
Yeah, so I'm really excited, and hopefully John will be calling in soon. For our listeners, I'm sure you know that we're waiting for John Wesley Shipp, and I guess he's just running late. I did go ahead and send him out something. So, okay, let me check that one. Area code 310.
Hello.
Hi.
Hi.
Is this John?
It is. It is John. Surprise.
Oh, yay.
Oh, okay.
We never know what phone number somebody's going to call in from, so, you know.
I know. Are we live now, or?
We are live.
We are
now, yes.
Oh, okay. That's good to know.
Yeah. So I'm going to go ahead and make the official announcement.
Great, right on.
Tonight we welcome two-time Daytime Emmy winner and all-around great guy, John Wesley Shipp. Thanks for joining us tonight, John. How are you doing today?
Thanks, I'm good. You know, I'm just really good. There's so many good things happening right now. You know, it's like somebody asked me that. I just got in from the gym and somebody said, "How you doing?" I said, "I'm great, man." They said, "Well, why do you sound surprised?" I said, "Well, you know, kind of in spite of all my efforts, you know, things were really terrific. I'm just really glad that we're finally connecting, and that the previous couple of times were misfires. So let me get that out of the way.
Well, you know, as they say, shit happens. So
yeah, well, that's true. All right, all right, get down. All right, I'm taking my cues from you.
Well, David is my co-host, and he's on with us. David, say hello to John.
Hi, John. How are you doing?
Hi, David. How are you?
I'm,
I thought I heard a man chuckling. I didn't know what was going on over there on that
yeah.
number one.
it's my split personality.
Yeah, I was going to say, you know.
Only
well,
for
I
you.
Know.
I mean,
well,
you have
happening?
A lot of different. You have a lot of different personalities too, from all the different characters you played. So, I'm sure that you got one or two or three.
Oh yeah, absolutely. Mm-hmm. It's frightening. I have to tell you, the last one though, the Teen Wolf Dad.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I've played some psychos, but rarely have I. There's a moment in that scene, the dinner table scene, when I sort of toss the first glass, you know, and it smashes
mm-hmm.
and. I can't even watch that. It's like, you know, I don't know, Ship, where you dug that up from, but let's just keep that buried. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
I mean, it's so creepy, you know?
Mm.
It's like, ugh. So anyway.
Something that you just don't want to really do anytime soon again, I guess, right?
Yeah, well, I didn't, because I had done it. You know, I mean, it wasn't quite written exactly that way, but
mm-hmm.
I thought, you know, you know, I was going like concerned parent. I said, you know, oh, okay, you clean up the kitchen, do the dishes. And I'm holding my cup and my drink, and he's relieved. And I say, and I do mean the entire kitchen. I just kind of slip the glass, smash. And then I go, you know what I'm saying? And
yeah.
I laugh. And I'm like, okay, that is really creepy. That's
yeah.
so creepy, I can't watch it.
Have you watched yourself on other things?
You know what, it's funny. It's weird. Somebody was talking to me the other day about a friend of theirs that they ran into was a big fan of The Flash, and he says, I watch all the episodes once a year. And I said, you know, there are episodes I still haven't seen. And the reason, I think, on that show was that it was like a runaway train. I mean, nobody had time to watch anything. And then after we were done with that excruciatingly exhausting season, the last thing you wanted to do was sit down and watch it.
Oh, I'm sure.
What I'm finding now is that I'm on Facebook. People are editing scenes together of projects.
Mm-hmm.
Like even Dawson's Creek, my friend Terry Pickett, he put together the end of Mitch's story, about 15
mm-hmm.
minutes from Dawson's and the beginning. I sat down and watched. I was like, oh, God, I don't even remember doing that scene. I didn't realize I was standing in the yard when Dawson drove away. Oh my God! You know, it's like it's strange. I find Pam and David that the further away I get from, are either of you guys actors? Do you see yourself on tape ever?
No, thank
no,
you.
No,
but I was going to say, because you would already know what I'm talking about. But I find that the further away I get from a project, the more objective I can be. Because it's like, I remember, you know, I had just done The Flash, and then I went and played a drug-addicted cop a couple years later on NYPD Blue, which was a completely different rhythm, completely different vibe than I had done. It was helped mm-hmm. because I was doing a play that was set in Brooklyn based on a true story at the same time, which kind of had that same accent, that same rhythm. So one said the other. But I knew what I had intended, and everybody, I didn't watch the premiere because I was probably crouched behind a potted plant. You know, if it had been on in the living room, I would have been hiding somewhere. But I watched it a couple days later, and I was so bummed out. I remember one time I watched a show that I had done, and I was so freaked out, and I was in L.A., but I drove to Idlewild. You know what I mean? It was like I just got in the car and drove because I knew what I intended in my mind's eye.
Mm-hmm.
Well, the further I get away from a project, I forget what I intended. So
And that's a good thing.
Yeah, it's a good thing. So then mm-hmm. I can watch and enjoy what I actually did. The only
right.
exception to that, and this is so odd because somebody on Facebook just asked me, they said, and it was a perceptive question, this kid must be an actor. But he said, was there a difference? He said, I've seen you play a couple different psychos, but I was wondering about Carter Jones and All My Children versus Eddie Ford and One Life to Live. Was
mm-hmm.
there a difference in your approach? And I said, that's a very perceptive question. I said, because the role in one of my first Emmy Ford, Douglas Cummings on As the World Turns, and then in 1992, Carter Jones on All My Children are on one side of a creative divide. Eddie Ford was an experiment in something I had never tried as an actor before, and that was, let's take everything we've learned, throw it out the window, you know, look at the script, and they gave me license. The writers were Ron Carlovati and Frank Valentini, who is like one of my favorite executive producers I have ever worked with. I cannot sing this man's praises enough. I have never actually, I mean, well, never, that's an exaggeration, but rarely does an actor, let's say, warm to the thought or the announcement that an executive producer is on his way to the soundstage during taping. But I was always relieved when Frank was there. And I found that out the very first scenes we taped when I was tied to the chair with the tape over my mouth. You
know,
because I saw Frank watch the monitor, and I saw him make adjustments. And I said, I get it. This is a creative producer. This isn't just a numbers cruncher. This guy has an eye, you know. But it was like they gave me license. They were very generous with me. They said, okay, here's the framework of the character. Go. And I remember the first thing I wanted to change was I wanted to throw in my first scene with my sons, I wanted to throw in, you know, I think we should get the whole family together and have a little prayer breakfast. And I was in rehearsal, and the director said, oh, no, you can't say that. I said, I can't say what? They said, you can't say prayer breakfast. I said, I just called my wife. I'm talking to my sons. I just called their mother a bitch, a slut, a whore. I just called one of them a pansy-ass boy. I can't say prayer breakfast? I said, let me talk to you, Frank. And I didn't know Frank by this point. And I said, Frank, I'm not making fun of religion. I said, believe me, the people in the people in the Midwest, the people who are watching our audience, by the time I get to that line, they'll be shaking their heads. Yep, if ever there was a family that needed a little prayer breakfast, it's the Fords. He said, okay,
right. And I'm in the Midwest, and I'll agree with that.
You know what I mean? Oh, my God, what a family. Talk about, I mean, they put the funk in dysfunction. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
It's like, it's the only thing he wouldn't let me say, and then I'll shut up for a second. But the only thing he wouldn't let me say was I came back to do the to do what I thought was great, which was I thought was like, man, this is the existentialist daytime version of existentialism. They asked me to come back. I was very honored for the last week of One Life to Live.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I thought, okay, one more version of Who Shot Eddie. I picked Bobby up off the gurney. I take him with me to the antechamber between heaven and hell, and we have this whole scene. My angel director, Jill Mitwell, directed the scenes. It was a very impressionistic set, black flats, lights, fire on one side of double doors, bright white light on the other side. And, you know, and it was, I just completely forgot why I was telling this story. I got so involved in my description. What the hell was I talking about? Oh, the one thing you didn't let me say.
Something they didn't want you to say.
The only thing Frank put let me say was at one point I'm laying on my back, looking up at the ceiling, and I say, it was written, I don't believe in second chances. And he says, well, I do, Bobby says. And my line was, tell it to the Marines. And he looks at me. And so I went, oh, yeah, we got some of them in here, too. Well, Frank chased me.
Oh, no.
He put his hands on my shoulders. He said, John, you can't say that we have Marines in hell. I said, Frank, I didn't say all the Marines were in hell. I just said, he said, Don, it's Memorial Day. We cannot say there are Marines. And I said, all right, uncle. He said, we have let you say anything you've wanted to say, you know. And they truly did. I swear, I felt on that set, man, if I had said, you know, at the end of this line, what if I set the sofa on fire? They all would have reached for their lighters. You know, it was just...
right?
It was most supported. And I'll tell you also, Susan Gammy, the costume designer, one of my first days there, before I worked, we were doing a costume fitting. She let me know, because, you know, it had been 18 years since I had done daytime, and it was vastly different. And I was going, man, how do you guys do this? She says, John, the way I look at it is, it's another day at the circus. And
oh.
I went, Okay, I know where my Eddie Ford is. And I threw out, is it supportive? Is it, you know, because, you know, with Douglas Cummings and with Carter Jones, they both had deep wounds that were apparent in the writing.
Right.
And I could wrap my wounds, you know, my actor's soul around that. And I could play them from the position of that wound. I got a great compliment from Ed Trott, head of PMG. He told Doug Marlin, he said, you know, if someone had told me this guy would be coming and terrorizing all these characters I've known and loved for 20 years and I would actually have sympathy for him, I would have told you you're crazy. He said, but what you and John have managed to do is exactly that. Well, that's because I played the wound. I didn't play the behavior. I played the wound that caused the behavior. With Eddie Ford, I read that and I was like, man, sister, I can hear TV sets. All these clicks you're hearing are the sounds of TV sets being turned off across America.
Oh.
So I said, the only way I know how to do this is run straight at it and make it as darkly funny as I can. And then when I found out that I could ad-lib, like at one point at the end with my little son, my youngest, I called the little bastard. Eddie knew that was his son. You know, it's clear, it's obvious. But yeah, I threw, he didn't even let me throw in, oh, yeah, because I was thinking height, because he was the shortest of my three sons. So on my way out, I was like, oh, yeah, and tell your little girlfriend when she's ready to supersize, she know where to find me.
Oh.
Let me tell you. The cameraman almost lost his shit, since you have said that word already. And he said, now, I know that was not in the script. And we just laughed. We had the best time, you know. But no, on Memorial Day, I could not say that there were Marines in hell. And I understand.
Yeah. it's great that they gave you a lot of leeway with it, you know, to do what you wanted, basically, and it worked well. I mean, we all hated you.
Yeah.
Oh, it was just despicable. Well, see, there was nothing, the only thing that I could sort of, and it confused audiences, my good friend Eric Neinheis, RetroRadioLive.com, I'm getting ready to go to New York and start a project up in New York. The first day of shooting is the 26th. You know, but he was co-host of RetroRadioLive.com, and I had an interview with him right when I first went on One Life to Live. And I'm an idiot. I break the actor's rule. I will actually go in to the blogs and the chat rooms to see what people are saying. Man, you better gird your loins is all I have to say.
Right.
You know what I mean? Holy smokes. Anyway, you know, just people were saying, because the character had been built up, you know, so it's like, I don't understand this guy. They've been talking about this villain. They expected this Teflon soap opera villain. And I went in exactly the opposite direction, you know, and I came in sort of, you know, this guy that the only thing I could really sort of empathize with was here is this sort of second rate, petty crime, petty Annie criminal with delusions of grandeur who wants to get in on the big time. He wants to get in with Jerry Van Oren character, who I forget what his
Clint.
I forget, but so Jerry and I worked on Ross Marler. I keep thinking of him from Guiding Light.
Yeah,
but anyway, whatever.
Clint Buchanan.
That's him, Clint Buchanan. You know, Eddie wanted, man, he wanted to be Clint Buchanan. Well, you know, I loved when Hillary Bailey Smith said, okay, well, you know, who came up with this idea? Because I know you. You know, she kind of snorted, you know. And that's exactly right. I mean, Eddie had these delusions. And the one time I felt really something for Eddie was when Bobby, who was obviously his favorite, we made that up out of whole cloth. I said, okay, from what we can tell, Bobby, you're my favorite. And that's why I let you get away with things I wouldn't let the other two. Obviously, James is softer. He reminds me of his mother. He's the one that bore the brunt of the abuse. And the little kid I've never met, but he's a cocky little bastard, and he just pops me. And I threw in the line, ooh, daddy's boy, you know, because I figured, you know, well, he's definitely mine. But, we did all these things that Bobby, you know, Bobby was the one that was most like me. And, And so we sort of created these relationships, and we played these relationships. But and I also forget the point that I was about to make there. But I had, and I don't want to monopolize the whole thing with One Life to Live, but the original point I was making is that I found right after I had done that, I will go back and watch Eddie Ford clips
mm-hmm.
more than any other, because I laugh. You know what I mean? I'm like, if nobody had ever seen any work I'd ever done, they'd go, man, this guy's not an actor. He's a vaudevillian. But, you know, it was another, it was Susan Gammie. It was another day at the circus. And I thought, it was like, okay, man, this is what we have. And we're not going to be texting during 5-minute breaks. And whenever we're not on camera, we're going to be trying to find different things. And I started throwing things at these kids. An early scene, I accidentally spit on Bobby while eating breakfast cereal. You can see his take. He looks down. He looks down. And then I thought, oh, my God, I've struck gold. So I think Bazil was threatened. You feel threatened by me? And so I thought, I have struck gold. So I started repeating the word threatening and spitting all over these boys.
Well,
they were traumatized by the time. And then it said, and then the character was supposed to say, okay, I have to go take a piss. So I thought, threatened. I crossed all the way around to the other. You feel threatened by me? Come here. I grabbed his head. I kissed it. Mwah. There. See, ain't nothing but love, baby. Instead of saying I have to take a piss, I went, oh, like was going to throw up. And I went, oh, God, and ran off. Well, it was like, they didn't know what had hit him. And the whole scene after that, he's never going to leave. You know, I think they were talking about me. But let me tell you, those boys caught on in a hurry, and they started giving back as good as they got. A director came on the set, and they said, he just looked at me, he said, have you been teaching your sons bad habits? And I said, oh, I do hope so. I love
that
those
was
boys.
That was a free acting lesson for them.
Well, you know what? And they cared. You know, they really cared. You know, there's a huge trap in daytime. And that is, you know, and I think I can say this not with absolute authority. I mean, come on. Yeah. I've never done an A-list movie, but I have done a Tony Award-winning Broadway play, and I have done Shakespeare, mm-hmm. and I have done Tennessee Williams at a prominent theater. You know, so it's like I was writing this analysis of Road Rage on Facebook. I said, better be careful, Schiff. You're writing your book on Facebook for free. You know, you got to pull back on the – anyway. What was I about to say? I was like, my work – what point was I about to make? Maybe that's my sign to have a – huh?
I don't know exactly what you were trying to get at.
I know.
David?
No.
It was, like, vitally important. It's like, you know...
Oh, about the kids learning from you and you went in from there.
Yeah. And they began to give back as good, and that they were like a kid. Yes, oh, they started giving back as good as they got. Anyway, that's the end of the story. He said, and I said, I do hope so, you know, because it's, you know, I mean, it's, oh, from Shakespeare, whether it's Shakespeare or whether it's soap, the trap in daytime is that, and I felt it a little bit in the halls of my life, is the trap you can fall into is, this is my day job. You know, I've done daytime in 18 years. I'm a primetime actor. Not me, man. I go in like, this is the greatest stuff I have ever done. And because I truly love the work, you know. And it's funny, that is infectious. When you start showing up, like, okay, this doesn't work, this doesn't work, this doesn't work. Okay, let's see what does work. Let's play. We're in the sandbox, man. You take the shovel, I'll take the bucket. You know, you kick sand in my face, you know. And then suddenly, that's infectious. The other attitude is also infectious. I'm too good for this, you know.
And you don't want that.
I'm just going to be texting my friends. No. You know, it's like if you think it doesn't work, then it's our obligation to even work harder to find a way to make it work. And if you don't enjoy doing that, then why are you an actor? You know what I mean?
Right, exactly.
That's how
exactly.
I feel about it anyway. But my son, let me tell you also, Jessica Leccia, That girl can act. Let me tell you, when she flew through that door, when I said, "Where's the man? Is Bobby?" You know, asked the whore in, and she flew in that door at me and went toe to toe. The only thing I had a hard time getting her to do was smack me. So we were in my dressing room. Uh-oh. If anybody had walked by, I swear we're crazy. I was like, "Smack me." She taps. I said, "That's a tap." I said, "Smack me. Smack." She went, "No." I said, "Yes. Again. 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 Again." I said, "Now that's," she about took my head off. I said, "Now that's a slap." She says, "Am I not hurting you?" I said, "No, as long as you stay away from my ear. But if you don't take my head off,
then
you know,
you're okay.
Our son." You know what I mean? And that sort of breaks my whole, you know, "I don't want to break it to you, sweetheart, but your woman's a slut." Smack.
Yeah.
Nate is our son. Ooh, sorry, kid.
No.
But anyway, don't want to spend the whole
time.
How
was your jaw, John?
Huh?
How was your jaw?
You know, that's the funny thing, though. You know, it's like, as long as someone keeps a flat hand, and I've done a lot of action parts, you know, like, as long as someone keeps a flat, open hand and catches the only danger in a slap, an open-handed slap, is if it gets too far back on your face and it hits your ear. Then you have a danger of a broken eardrum. But, you know, I just smacked myself with an open palm. You know, I don't know if you heard that, but that was pretty loud. That didn't hurt. You know?
I did hear something.
Plus, I needed that because my next moment was, because I was on a roll, you know. I was like, what are you, robbing in the cradle? Geez, I don't know. You know, your woman's a slut, sweetheart. I'm talking to my son. She smacks me, and I'm stunned. I'm like, sorry, kid. My mistake. And we see Eddie for one of the first time, maybe caught off guard. You know, then he finds out the son's name is Nathaniel, and he goes back. He goes, "Oh, yeah, Nathaniel? Nathaniel? I know you hear your boy's wolf name," and he's back to being Eddie. But that slap helped me, you know what I mean? It stopped me in my tracks. Because then it was like a locomotive. Anyway, what do you guys want to talk about?
I don't know. I think we're lost now.
Oh, don't make me joke on my protein cake.
We love your stories.
You like it, yeah.
Well, I have to tell you that David was telling me last night that you actually were singing on Guiding Light at one point, and I went on YouTube and found the wonderful Land of John Wesley Shipp videos from Terrence and sat there for I don't know how long watching so many different things and just reliving the things that I had watched before and watching the ones I hadn't seen before. And I found the one on Guiding Light where you were singing, and it was like just before your wedding, and you were singing with Morgan. And I was blown away. You have such a great voice.
Thank you. You know, I did as a joke. In fact, my friend Lorraine Milana, who's a very good friend, she was the assistant to Felicia Bear, who was my wonderful executive producer, who was so supportive when I did the Carter Jones story in 1992 on All My Children. And I did this video. I put up this video. It's like I woke up one morning. I didn't have coffee. So I've never done this before in my life. And so I came up with the coffee song. And like I'm singing all off key. I said, you know, I don't know why I did it. I did it mostly because, you know, I tell people this. When I was at Sundance, sometimes I get confused with John McGinley. And I knew at Sundance, if someone came up and said, "I laughed so hard when you," I knew they were talking about John McGinley. Mm-hmm. And if they came up to me and they said, "I cried," I knew they were talking about me. Well, the point being, you know, with my politics and with my think, it can get pretty heavy. So I thought, you know, I'm in a silly mood. I'm going to tell them, of course, my friend Donna Parker Price from high school. She and her husband John, whom I set up on their first date, by the way. Okay, all these years later, still together.
Matchmaker.
You know, exactly. but she said, she wrote, now I know you've lost your damn mind, you know. And so people were saying, well, I know one thing you didn't have was a musical career. And I went, you know, funny you should mention. Actually, as an opera theater major in the, you know, as a voice performance major in the opera theater department at Indiana University, Bloomington, you know, and, you know, studied piano. But I said, I also happen to be an actor, and I love that quote from Rosencrantz and Guildenstern, something like, we were demented children, mincing about in clothes no one ever wore, speaking words no one ever spoke, killing each other with wooden swords, swearing empty vows of vengeance after hollow protestations of faithfulness, whatever it is. It says, and all of it, every word, every gesture, vanishing into the thin, unpopulated air. Now, this is the phrase I really like. It says, we ransomed our dignity to the clouds, and the uncomprehending birds listened. Don't you see? We're actors. We're the opposite of people.
Yeah.
Is that not heavy?
That's,
I mean,
that's,
and that
great,
says it.
Yeah.
You know?
I've never heard that before.
Yes, Rosencrantz, it's Tom Stoppard and Rosencrantz. Don't you see? We're actors. We're the opposite of people.
Yeah. Wow. I love that. Well, I think you should do a CD or something of songs, because I'm sure there's a lot of people out there that would buy it.
Well, you know, we did that in Guiding Light. I released an album with a producer from the ABBA organization. But, you know, I was classically trained, and I did not like musical theater because of it being very presentational. You know what I mean? I don't like the presentational aspect of musical theater. So I kind of shied away from that, although I did Curly at Oklahoma at Sullivan Theater, and you know, but few and far between. I did a wonderful musical project with Judith Ivey at the West End called Philco Blues, but it was a very dark, underlying psychosexual themes, rhythm and blues, quasi-country and western. Faith Prince, who won the Tony for God, she was in it. Barry Cullison, Judith Ivey. I mean, it was a very interesting project. And I also did Side by Side by Sondheim, and Sondheim elevated musical theater to a point beyond which, you know, I heard an interview with Mandy Patinkin 2 weeks ago. He said, I study Sondheim lyrics every day.
Really?
And I thought, I know exactly what he means. You know, you listen to songs like, you won't go away. What is it? As the days go by, I keep thinking, when does it end? You know, I mean, when's the day I'll have started forgetting? You know, instead I keep on swearing and sweating and waiting and crying and whatever and whatever, you know. You know, and I die day after day after day after day as the years go by. I mean, it's a whole different world, you know. I did Side by Side by Sondheim. I got to sing I Remember Sky. I got to sing, because they gave it to the man, the woman song in Bali's, but Could I Leave You, he gave to the man in, when they put it in Side by Sondheim. I got to sing Anyone Can Whistle. It's like these are art songs. He elevated the Broadway musical. Now, there were some people who said, like, Sunday in the Park with George was that was the big debate. You know, he was so in his head. Let me tell you, I've never had a more emotional experience than I had during Sunday in the Park with George, because it appealed to my head and my heart. If it only appeals to my heart, it's sentimental. If it only appeals to my head, it's analytical and cold. He hits me, I don't know, and apparently I'm not alone, you know, both my head and my heart. You know what I mean? So it's pretty incredible. But, yeah, we did an album, and then I was supposed to go to Sweden to record in the ABBA studios. And, you know, the direction that we were going in was not one that I particularly liked, and I had an opportunity to do some Connecticut, and never being the most business savvy, I mean, I could be, you know, had I done that. But I went off to do Three Musketeers, and that was the end of my recording career.
Aww.
Well, you know what? I kept singing for myself. The problem is, it's like when I was doing Dancing at Lunasa on Broadway, and they asked me to do Carter Jones, who is a real crazoid. I mean, beating up Melody Anderson and then crying and snotting because she wouldn't, I just wanted her to love me, you know,
yeah.
And screaming and yelling. I hemorrhaged a vocal cord.
Oh, no.
And it was very funny. It was during a performance, but that last week, I was doing 30 to 40 pages of dialogue myself on all my children and 8 performances of Dancing at Lunasa a week.
Oh, my God.
It was incredible. For 4 months, it's one of the most exciting periods of my life. I'd be at ABC at 7 a.m. on a matinee day. They'd have a car waiting for me, take me. I'd do the matinee. They'd have a car waiting, take me back to ABC. I'd tape until... I had to be back at the theater at 7:30. I'd do the show until 11. I'd go home. I'd rewrite all my lines. That's not true. I don't want to say that because the writers gave me wonderful material. They also let me, that was the show where they said, the director said, well, you're the only actor I've ever met who cuts his own lines. And I said, well, I would rather say something once, you know. I said,
that's,
you know, I've got to say this 3 times. Mm-hmm. What if we cut these 2? What if we move this one down here?
Mm-hmm.
You know, so they got that it wasn't about my ego, you know,
right.
Except that my ego is very invested in being. I read something that Pap, the famous guy from Public Theater. I'm sorry. My apologies to the, you know, Webiverse for Topaz. I think that's his name. Anyway, he talked about Don McKechnie. Oh, Jesus Christ. I am just so fumbling all over this. The point was the lead in Chorus Line. And he said she has, and I can't remember exactly how he put it, but an almost, not desperate, but something along those lines, desire to be good, you know? And I thought, man, I connect with that. And to that extent, that's where my ego is, you know? I want to be good. I'm not the greatest actor that ever lived. Please, you know? I mean, that becomes evident early on. But I'm talking personal best, you know? Whatever.
Right, the
I'm
best
given.
That you can be.
Yeah, the best that I can be. Now, in 2 weeks, I'm headed back to New York. My voice teacher is still in New York, poor Mayan Bishop. He is so awesome. And I've had many voice teachers. My voice teacher at IU sang Tosca with Maria Callas at the Met in 1958, recorded Ballad of Baby Doe with Beverly Sills, sang Wagner all over the world with Birgit Nilsson. Okay. But I have to say, and he was great, Walter Castle, but I have to say, Mayan Bishop is a voice healer. And I went to him, I did not even have 1 octave. And we will work for 3, 4, 5, 6 months to the point where I can get through an art song or leader or something again. And then I'll go and do one of my crazy roles and rip and rear through my book. And then I'll come back in shreds as I'm about to do again.
Yeah.
And he'll say, okay. Now, he must get really tired of it's like continually I'm in the remedial voice class, you know what I mean? But he's so wonderful, and I intend to start studying again. Music I pretty much have kept for me, and my dad being a minister, I've done a lot of singing in church,
right?
And that's pretty much what it's been for me. I was for 1 whole year the music director at New Community of Faith in San Jose. My dad was doing an interim pastorate out there, wild little church. I just loved it. And I took a year off from acting, 2009, played the piano and organ, sang, did programs, put together programs, you know, quartets and stuff. But I was singing and playing every Sunday for an entire year. I only did an independent film, Separation Anxiety, that I had already agreed to. And then Warner Brothers asked me to voice an episode of Batman the Brave and Bold to play Professor Zoom, which was the character I played in the 1991 series, Barry Allen's arch enemy. They thought it would be cool for the fans if I flipped and was my own worst enemy. So that I did. But other than that, I turned down everything. I spent this whole, in this little church in the Bay Area, making music with these wonderful, loving, accepting people where I could just be authentic. And it was one of the happiest years in recent memory. You know what I mean? So
right.
I don't know.
You needed some downtime and just to be yourself for a little while, and
yeah.
you enjoyed what you did, and you made other people happy, and that's a good thing for everybody.
Yeah,
right.
It
make everybody
for me. I have to say, I think music was my gift, and for a combination of reasons, I sort of went into acting at a point where things became difficult because it was easier. Now, that should tell you something about how screwed up I am. Who becomes an actor because it's easier? You know, and I think I'm a good actor. I think I could have been. This is maybe a little bit too self-revelatory, but anyway, I think I could have been a great musician because I studied piano since I was before my fifth birthday. I was giving concert organ recitals at 12, 13, 14. I was carted off to the voice teacher at 17. I went on a voice performance scholarship to Indiana University. I dropped out. But that is, I've always said, you know, I sort of put acting together with spit and chewing gum after music became, for a variety of physical and psychological reasons, too difficult. You know what I mean? I don't know
right.
if that's neither here nor there, but thank you for your comments
yes.
about my voice.
Oh, you're very welcome. I know
thank
that
you.
David had a guiding light question for you. David, you want to hit
yeah.
him up?
Yeah, I'll hit you up. Let me see. John?
Just don't hit him. Okay.
I won't hit him. I'll open my hand.
Or if you do, yeah, flatten your hand and avoid my ear. It's all good.
As a young guiding light enthusiast, I followed your tortured love story of Kelly and Morgan. I found it slow, steady, and at times irritating, because I was always waiting for Morgan to wise up.
Yeah.
For me, Marlon knew how to tell a story. What were your opinions of the story?
I have to tell you, I say, you know, I have been, and I don't know what word to use anymore. I can't really say blessed, because if I imply that I'm blessed, then that implies that other people are not blessed, which implies that I believe in a God who plays favorites, and I don't. But I have been fortunate to have been brought together with creative influences at really peak moments in my life. And that was one of them. I mean, I was like, if you were going to do daytime, to have hooked up with daytime at the beginning of 1980, which was headed yep. into the peak of the youth boom and the viewership. I mean, the numbers
right.
we were getting then.
Yes,
you know,
they were.
And not only then, but Doug Marlin, I mean, my God, it was like, you know, he had basically with Corey Amonte created the Luke Laura-Scotti triangle, took General Hospital number one, and
mm-hmm.
Roger Gavin brought him over to CBS to do the same thing for it, and he had Kelly Morgan Nolan, Hillary, et cetera. But it was, he was so invested in those characters, and it was a joy to play because he really cared, and he had been an actor, and that can be a trap. My God, I've worked with directors who have been actors, and it can either be a really good experience or a really bad one. You know, I actually had to say to one director not too long ago, I get it. If you were playing the part, that's how you would do it. I get it.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I mean? But anyway, yeah, the way that he would weave stories, and it became even more apparent. And then how lucky was I? I mean, I went off of Guiding Light in 1984.
Yeah.
And Doug Marlin had bailed and had ended up at As the World Turns. And then he knew that there was more to me than Kelly Nelson. So
he did.
One day presented me with a 30-page document and said, what do you think of this story? And I read it, and it was all backstory. He had figured all of the backstory out. You know what I mean? I mean, when Douglas Marlin wrote an outline, he would write examples of dialogue. He would write the taglines of the scenes. before. I mean, his outlines were, what, 12, 15 pages? And then he'd hand them to his writers to do the scenes, and then he'd rewrite, and he wanted kept each character's voice different. You know? I went to, you know, another show, and it was like, act one, so-and-so and so-and-so have a fight in the kitchen. Act two, I'm like, what?
After working the other way.
You know what I mean? It was like the outlines were 2 pages long. It was like, how on earth do they write, you know, that way? But he was one in a million, and, you know, he was the last of that kind of, I mean, he really was on Guiding Light. He was really unique. I mean, in those days, the producers tried to keep the writers and the actors separate because they would have more power. If they didn't like an actor, they'd go to the writer and say, you know, so-and-so doesn't really like your writing.
Oh,
you know,
my God.
Or if they wanted to intimidate an actor, they'd say, oh, I don't know, the head writer isn't happy with you.
Oh.
But see, Doug was an actor and loved actors, so he talked to us, which cut through all the bullshit.
Right.
You know?
Yeah.
And I don't know how it was for everybody else, but and I'm sure I had the best of it because Kelly was his first new character. Morgan, he was very invested in that storyline. Nola, he was very invested in those storylines. So, you know, I had the best of the best at the peak of when daytime audiences were at their peak. You know what I mean? How lucky was I? And after playing 4 years of squeaky clean, the guy every mother's would want her daughter to be with, you know, that guy,
right.
I got to take that guy into As the World Turns and play him all the way out to stark, raving, frigging crazy. So immediately I got to break type. And ever since then, I tell people it's been superheroes and psychopaths, you know, and I wouldn't have it any other way. You know, how lucky am I?
You were lucky.
That's
John,
funny.
I have to tell you. I'm sorry.
Huh? No,
John,
go ahead, David.
Douglas Cumming's story was, to me, one of the best stories on daytime.
Let me tell you, I agree with you. Not only that, it was one of the best stories that's ever been told on television. My mom, because she was curious, she, I don't know how long this took, but she edited from As the World Turns, my 8 or 10 months, whatever you were, every scene that touched on or related to the Douglas Cumming story. Before we ever knew it was the Douglas Cumming story. From the minute I went on, if there was a murder, before anybody connected it with me, if anything that later on you found out, oh, my God.
Yep.
You know, and believe me, the phones lit up at CBS that day when they found me in the secret room. But Mom said, you know, it's amazing. She said, I've tracked it. And she edited it together like a miniseries. And my entire family had said, you need to sit down and watch this. To date, this is some of the best work you have ever done, you know.
Wow.
And she said, the amazing thing is, you know, I come in as Fran, as the answer to Julianne Moore's problems, right? Okay.
Right.
Then on one end of the story, Kim starts getting all these secret admirer gifts. Nobody connects that to me. On the other side of town, murders start happening. Nobody connects the murders to the secret admirer. Connects either of them to me. He had 3 storylines going that he had to wind together. Mom said, do you know there's not one slip up? There's not one instance of you being somewhere that would have made it impossible for you to have, in other words, every time Kim found a note or a gift, I had just been at the house.
Mm-hmm.
You know, if there had been a murder committed across town and due to some screw-up, he had had me at the restaurant, everybody knew I was at the restaurant, I couldn't have done it. She said there's not one pickup in the entire tracking of that 3-pronged story from beginning to end. Well, I mean, that's how often does that happen? I mean, even in
that's
time,
genius.
Wait a minute.
It was.
Wait a minute. He was over here. He couldn't have. he didn't have time to get over there and murder, you know, and come back. Wait a minute. When was he at the house? When did he leave that gift? And if he wasn't there right before she found the gift, how come the gift was there that long before she found it? You know, it's all tracked. You know?
Wow. Yeah, that's genius. I mean, he was just an incredible writer and creator. I mean, I think, you know, it helped that he understood actors with being an actor himself and how he wanted the storylines to go.
Oh, he was. He was. It was so funny. One thing I'll always remember, he would drop in at the studio, you know, and he came in one day and, you know, I could tell he was just, I said, what on earth is up with you? And he said, well, we just had a meeting. You know, Joshua the Devil, and they were saying something. They would always talk about the focus groups, you know. Mm-hmm. And I remember his take on the focus groups. He said he got so mad because they were saying, well, Doug, you know, because let me tell you, at the beginning, telling Morgan Nolan's story, the ratings, it's like plummeted. And it's like when you're gardening, you know, you have to prune the bushes back and then the new shoots grow. Well, they didn't understand that, so they're freaking out. Well, the focus groups, they don't like this, they don't like that. I said, I slam my hands down on the table. I said, if I hear, and when Doug got angry, he'd shake.
Mm-hmm.
If I hear the word focus group this and walking out that door, he said, not because I have no respect for our audience, but because people, if you did everything the focus group wanted, every crime would be solved, every couple would be together and happy, every villain would be punished, and you'd have no story.
Exactly.
So he'd say, mm-hmm. Tell a story. And they did, you know, and they certainly reaped the benefits of it, you know.
Well, thank God he was the one with the brains, you know.
Yeah.
Well, first of all, you know, we talk about the days of the old studio system movies when the David O. Selznicks, we had creative executive producers, instances, no disrespect. We have sitting positions of authority at networks and studios,
mm-hmm.
all of them, obviously, that are numbers crunchers. And they basically have formulas. And,
mm-hmm.
and they don't have a sense of continuity. They don't have necessarily a creative vision. What they have is a formula for ratings that they plug people into according to the TVQ, according to their, you know, a European audience quotient, you know. This is why I love Frank Valentini. I think he is a creative executive producer. I mean, you know,
oh, we love them. We love
we
them.
Love
we, they're our them. Heroes, and now they're on General Hospital creating magic there, so.
You know, and he would take, I mean, Frank Valentini would do whatever was necessary. You know, he would be there 1 minute looking at the screen going, well, what about this shot? We need a shot here. Go back here and take this. Go back here and take that. And the next minute, he'd be pulling off his tie and moving scenery. The next minute, he'd be putting it back on and taking the kids to do an interview. I mean, this man was indefatigable, you know? Indefatigable?
Mm-hmm.
How do you say that word? You know what I mean?
Infallible.
Tireless. How's tireless? Let's go with tireless.
That works.
That works.
Yeah. And Doug Marlin was like that. He was really, during his tenure, while I worked with him, he was the old school head writer, the head writer slash executive producer. You know what I mean? And
mm-hmm.
and the smart ones, like Cal, you know, he got it. And he worked with Doug instead of resisting Doug. You know what I mean?
Right,
in other
right.
words, instead of an executive producer digging in and saying, hey, you're encroaching on my territory, he got that he was working with a genius.
Right.
And his genius was in facilitating Doug's vision on world terms. You know?
Right.
Guiding
yep.
light. And then, so, I don't know. I don't know if that answers your question, but, you know, it was a dream. I mean, if you were going to do daytime TV, doing it in the early 80s, and having Douglas Marland be your head writer and you be the first character that he's bringing on the show is the catbird seat. You know?
Right. I could understand that.
He was very generous. You know, when I won my first Emmy, someone had said, you know, you must be very proud of John, but he said, oh, what a great story. And he said, without missing a beat, he said, you know, I've written a lot of stories for a lot of actors. They don't all win Emmys.
No, yeah.
And that's what he was, you know. He was just that way, you know.
Wow.
Now, the people he did not like or did not respect or he felt did not try, did not give, I'm sure they would have an entirely different perspective.
Yeah,
I would imagine.
Or for some reason they didn't jive, or you know, we all have those. But I know that, you know, if you talk to, you know, Lisa Brown, I mean, my God, the whole final. You said you waited for Morgan to get it when Kelly finally found out what Nola was up to, and the first 22 minutes of the show were me and Lisa Brown going at each other.
Yep.
I mean, he was so much a part of that process. We were on the phone to him. I mean, rewrites were coming in at the last minute. We were going, it just doesn't feel. What do you think about this? Let's try that. And then Harry Eggert, God bless him, the director, said, okay, you know, I don't remember a time when the first 22 minutes of an hour show had been two characters going at each other, but this is built up, and I'm going to put one camera on you, John, and I'm going to put one camera on you, Lisa, and we're going to have a two-shot at the fourth camera. He said, go. And wherever you are, I will be there.
Oh.
I mean, geez. That's what I mean about, you know, I came up with people who were better looking than me, who were every bit as talented, who, for whatever reason, some people call it a destiny, some people call it destiny, fate, luck, chance, whatever you think it is, you know, we're in position to take it down. In other words, I'm suffering under no delusion that I've had the career that I've had because I'm more talented than the people that failed because they had families and weren't making enough money. I'm not suffering under that delusion,
mm-hmm.
and I'm really glad because I know actors that are. They think, oh my God, this is all about me.
No.
But I have been at certain points in my career, you know, available for transitions. Kelly Nelson, 4 years of A Good Guy, goes into Douglas Cummings. I immediately break type. Goes into, you know, Broadway. My first time on Broadway, goes into a superhero. We're on this star of the most expensive show Warner Brothers had ever done for television, which was a critical and an industry hit, and which corporate CBS at the Tonys the following year apologized to me because they had mishandled that show.
Oh, wow.
They all realized
it.
You know, going into the character on NYPD Blue, going into super nice dad. I mean, I can look at Mitch Leary now and I don't see me, and I go, God, you were a good dad. You know?
Yeah.
I mean, I look at that scene where he's teaching Dawson how to kid, and that's Kevin Williamson, genius. Want to talk about another genius? The scene where this construct blows my head wide open. At one point, Dawson's making a horror film. So he has a prosthetic head of Joey who's about to be decapitated in the scene they're shooting that night. He is in love with Jen and is curious about how do you kiss a girl. So Mitch says the head is sitting on the table. He says, well, practice. He picks up the head of Joey. Meanwhile, we don't know that Joey has snuck in and is watching the scene from above.
I love that. I watched it last night again, so I know exactly what you're talking about.
As Dawson practices kissing Jen on a prosthetic head of her.
Mm-hmm.
Now, if that's not a construct that you, I mean, that blows my mind. Why not?
Was that Joey was up there, you know, imagining him kissing her when he's kissing that dummy head.
He's kissing, not only is he kissing the dummy head of her, but he's practicing to kiss Jen.
Right.
That's what made it brilliant. It's like having someone watch the guy or the person that you know, you have the hots for your love, whatever it is at that age.
Mm-hmm.
So that you're attracted to kissing your image, but practicing to kiss someone else. You know, I mean,
yep.
To me, that is the makings of genius. You know,
yep.
You know what I mean?
Yeah, I know. I relived that last night when I was watching all the different videos that the wonderful Terry put up there for everybody to watch. And I so miss Dawson's Creek, but I have to tell you that when I was watching it, I used to work at this call center. It was a very small place, and I worked the evening shift. And there was about four or five of us girls that would work. And we had this little TV set up, and everybody would, you know, sit around the little TV to watch Dawson's Creek. We could never miss a minute of it. And when the, you know, phone rang, nobody wanted to get up to answer it. They're like, it's your turn. No, it's your turn. You know, that kind of thing. And we absolutely loved it. And I just enjoyed your part so much, you know, being so loving with your wife, although Dawson thought it was perverted. And with you standing in the yard and then getting killed. And by the way, I had forgotten about this. You were singing in the car eating that ice cream when you got yourself killed.
People
and we all cried like babies.
People, I have two stories about that. People were incensed. I said, no, you don't get it. I said, I had a choice. They gave me the choice. Fire and rain, which is what they ended up ending the episode with.
Mm-hmm.
Or this happy, joyous song. And I said, well, it seems very zen to me. There's been conflict between me and Dawson the whole episode. We find
right.
out later that I've gone and had a conversation with this guy at the convenience store, and it has been resolved in my mind.
Right.
I am driving home with all this weight I've been carried, having been lifted off my shoulders. All is well in the world. I am
yep.
singing along. The ice cream flies, and that was an inside joke because I, you know, it's like, you know, they used to call me the ice cream man on set. I have an ice cream addiction. Anyway,
oh.
and I'm like singing along. The ice cream flies off the cone. I bend down and up and boom.
Yeah.
That's perfect. And nobody saw it coming. There's a whole story about how that came about, too, but I don't know how much time we have. You know, it's 8:01. I don't know how long this show is supposed
to be. Depends how long you want to talk.
Yeah.
But it was funny. I have a friend, Lisette Rodas, who is from Cuba, and his family is in Cuba. And they get it on delay. And a friend of my family's and my sister Karen. And they all know Karen, who has been to Cuba. And my sister Karen. So at my phone keeps beeping. It's not interfering with you guys. But anyway, at one point, Lisette's family called, and there were a couple of people on the phone, and they were crying. And they were like, he's dead. He's
yes.
dead. And Lisette, being from Cuba, says, Fidel died? And they said, no, Karen's brother.
Because
they had just seen, you know, on a delay, the show in which Mitch Leary dies. And they, of course, knew Karen, and they knew that I was her brother. So they said, and Lisette, they're also upset. They said, she said, Fidel died? They said, no, Karen's brother.
Well, we all cried. All of us at work, we all cried. We just couldn't believe that happened.
Well, it was, you know, it was very interesting. I had done 4 years. The parents, during season 3 and season 4, season 1 and season 2, you know, we had a lot to do. I mean, we had what I was promised. Kevin said, I will not turn you into 90210, parents,
mm-hmm.
you know. And we had independent storylines, subservient to the kids, or subsidiary and intersecting storylines, but our own. We had the open marriage, and everything was reflected. What was going on in the kids' life was reflected in the parents' life and so forth.
Right.
You know, people forget that at the beginning we were the critically acclaimed Dawson's Creek, that we
mm-hmm.
were editor's choice, that nobody had seen anything like it. It had a different sound. you know.
Right.
It was each, you know, third season, fourth season. By fourth season, you know, it was a matter of, and I think they were preparing this, you know, they're probably right to do so. The kids were going to go off to college next year. So they were de-emphasizing home life at the Creek in preparation for the kids to go to college. But for me as an actor, it began to be like, okay, let's get the script to see what I'm not doing this episode. You know
no.
what I mean?
No.
And so you're in Wilmington, and that begins to hurt your heart, you know what
yeah.
I mean, as an actor.
Yeah.
So when they let all of the adults' contracts lapse at the end of season four because they wanted to renegotiate, we weren't going to be in, I wasn't going to be in 19 or 20 of the 21, 22 episodes, you know. They only wanted
mm-hmm.
six. And I thought, you know what, I'm going to set my price really, really high because it's been such a good experience. I don't want to go back. I know what's going to happen. That, you know, Mary Margaret and I are going to be holding Lily, standing in the background, you know, at Parents Day at college and waving. I said, you know, I really don't want it to. So I set my price really high. They started shooting the first episode. I was fine. You know, I was out as far as I was concerned. They would never meet the price. Mm-hmm. Then I get a call from Paul Stupin. Can I have coffee with you in L.A.? So he comes out. He says, I'll level with you. He said, the WB has shut us down because we don't have storylines during the filming of the first episode of this fifth season. And so we know that you have been less than thrilled. I forget what he said. I don't think he said increasingly unhappy. I hope he didn't say that. But anyway,
right.
you know, you know, less and less, you know, pleased as the years have gone on. And so we need a story. We need something that will propel us through this season. And what we have come up with, and what I want to know, is if we give you the money you're asking, will you come back for two episodes, and we promise you two great scripts, will you come back for two episodes and kill the character? Well, I about lost my blueberry muffin right there.
Right.
In, you know, the coffee shop. You know, my latte almost landed in his lap. You know, it's like, kill the character, you know? I mean, but then I thought, you know, I quite frankly, by that point, the focus was so on the kids. I didn't really even expect two great scripts. But when I read them, then I went back and did them, and Raper Prange directed that last episode with that big sweep where I'm looking and smiling, going away and panning, and I walk into the house and the camera pans up into the sky. I mean, was ever a character given a more respectful... I got to tie up all my relationships with each of the kids. I mean, it was a dream come true. It made me feel like the previous 4 years had been about something. You know what I mean?
Right. Yeah, I can understand that.
They were two of the most beautiful. I look at it now, thanks to Terry, and I think, my God, how fortunate for me. I mean, not for them. I would not have wished that the WB shut them down during the filming
right.
of the first episode, or that we had been de-emphasized to the point of them only wanting six episodes from us. But the combination of events created a perfect storm where these two phenomenal episodes were born that tied up my entire story the last
mm-hmm.
previous 4 years of my life.
Right.
So,
right, yeah, it was a definite closure for you.
You know, as my mom, the minister's wife, says, she's got a very wry sense of humor. You know, Baptist minister's wife, she says, you know, if things like this keep happening, I might have to start believing in the Holy Spirit.
Oh.
Well, Mom, you know, you might want to think about that, you know.
Yeah.
She's only been a pastor's wife for 60 years, you know.
Yeah.
Oh, boy.
Well, we'll take a break from talking for 1 second because we do have a couple calls on hold, and I'd like to bring them on one at a time. And the first one, I think you know this dude, so let's see.
Uh-oh.
Area code 718. I know who you are, but go ahead.
Hello.
Hello.
Hi, how you doing?
Who is this?
the person you've been talking about for the last hour.
Yeah, right?
Terry?
Yeah.
Terry? Hi, Terry. Terry, how are you doing, man?
All right, I'm fine.
It's so awesome. Let me tell you about this guy. This guy, of course, I met through Facebook. This guy has made such a contribution to me professionally and personally. You know, I mean, I don't know where, Terry, you come up with these scenes and these pictures and these things and you edit. But believe me, my mom thanks you. My dad thanks you.
I thank him.
You know what I mean? I mean, I really sat down and I watched some of the scenes I had never seen from Dawson's Creek. I had not seen. I had forgotten. I'm like, wait a minute, I'm not in this scene. What was this scene? You know, and he took, now, the big scenes that I had used on my resume reels, obviously I knew. And the portions of the scenes that I had cut out and used, I knew very well. But what happened before and what came after, and what Terry has is an incredible eye. He will pick moments that are not the moments that necessarily everyone is the most familiar with, but are the moments that invested the peak moments with their impact. You know what I mean? It's like in singing. Let's say you have a high note in a phrase. You hammer away at that high note, and you can hammer away at that high note, but until you fix the notes that come three notes before, you
mm-hmm.
will never get that high note. You'll never get it, because the problem isn't the high note. The problem is you're singing the high note before you get there. You know what I mean? And
right.
so you know, he will pick the moments that, as like I say, you know, everybody's the big emotional moments. You know, when the shit hits the fan, you know, in Phil Spector, and that's on my mind, Pacino's brilliant performance in HBO's Phil Spector, and Helen Mirren, if anybody hasn't seen that, run to your computers, HBO, whatever, and watch Phil Spector, dialogues and directing by David Mamet. But, you know, it's like when it gets to the climax and everything, the spit's flying and everything's raging, you have created up to that point is logical and doesn't violate your sense of emotional truth, then you're soaring. And the big moment that everybody thinks is so hard plays itself if you get out of the way.
Right.
What is tricky are all the, you know, and some people get really pissed off at actors because actors will say, I have often been one of them. Well, that violates my sense of truth. Or I don't really think that at that moment, and people will think, they look at each other like, you know, why are you obsessing over this? Minutia. This is like a subsidiary. It's like, yeah, but if we get this right, then the big moment will play itself if I get out of the way. If we get this wrong, you know, or if it, and by wrong, I mean there are a million ways to fit. You have to run with the horses you have. You can't run with the horses you wish you had. So you have an actor with an emotional instrument, you know, with a set of wiring. Certain things make sense to that actor. You have to run with that actor. You know, you have to find out where is his sense of truth and how is he emotionally wired. And if all of that stuff makes sense, then the big moment plays itself. And if it doesn't, the big moment is forced, the actor doesn't believe it, you know. I've always felt that what comes before the climax is, I'm not alone. This is no big revelation. I'm not deluded enough to think that I have discovered this. You know, great acting truth, but, you know, I certainly have lived it out that, man, the moments before, and Terry has an eye for that. So Terry
Definitely.
Will grab those moments that I've forgotten. You know, and put them together and send them to me. And I'm telling you, 12, 13 years later, and if we're talking about Flash, now we're talking 21, 22 years later. If we're talking about As the World Turns or Guiding Light, I don't even want to say. You know what I mean? I got
right.
a collage from him the other day, and I was like, this is, okay, the first shot was 1982. Flash for Project 2012. 40 friggin' years. I have to go get my cane. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
but to have that all put together, you know, is not only rewarding for me, but imagine the contribution that that is in terms of networking, in terms of keeping my presence alive, in terms of putting it up in Facebook. You know, I'm a person who has never networked, and I'll shut up right after this because I want Terry to talk. I've never networked. I'm embarrassed by it. I don't go to the cocktail parties. People who are networking, even the legitimate networking, for some reason, I got that there's something wrong with that, you know. And we've talked about it in our family. You know, at one point, my parents, dad will turn to mom. Oh, our parents cursed us with ethics, and we passed it on to our children. So, but this is me. The whole game of, everybody's sort of eating their way up the food chain, you know, at these parties, and I don't go. I won't. I have a very hard time. As soon as I find out that you're a producer and you're in a position to give me a job, I shut down. If you're not, you know, I usually get along really well with my colleagues, with the crew, you know, because I know that I'm not manipulating them to get something from them. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
But you know, sometimes it's, and I totally forgot where that was going. But whatever, however that fits in, you know. Oh, networking. The networking, the value of this is the thing together. And you know, I'm such a son of a bitch. I said, you know, Terry, yeah, the part where they announce all the can you add that? I'm like, I know, I got a lot of nerve. And the arguments we've had over the soap bubbles, in fact, you know, I mean, it's very funny, actually. Don't you think, Terry? Are you laughing? I hope.
Oh, the bubbles, yes. Your favorite effect.
He loves to put soap bubbles in. Well, of course. Let me tell you. I and Robin Trent Jefferson and Sue Cam and a whole bunch of people have been, for 2 or 3 years, been trying to talk Terry Pickett into doing a coffee table soap opera book. This man knows more. He is a daytime TV historian. He knows more about, I mean, he's forgotten more about daytime than I ever knew. You know what I mean?
Right.
In terms of this show debuted here to these ratings. It was replaced by this show. Let's see. What ratings did The Chew get? How long did it last? Oh, so this show had been on for 25 years. To these ratings, the show that replaced it lasted for a minute and a half. And
right.
So, I mean, he puts everything in context, and then he comes up with Sherita Bauer, you know, Sherita Bauer, dear Sherita, you know, back in the old days, or he'll pull in Mary Stewart, or and he'll put things that are like 20 or 30 years apart, and he'll combine them in tape. And you're giving this all away for free. You need to do the soap opera coffee table book because he truly
knows. I think
knows
so
more.
Too.
It's not like I'm a novice
yep.
to daytime. I started in daytime 42 years ago. Isn't that when 1980 was? 8, 9, 10, 11, 43 mm-hmm. years ago. So I'm not a novice to daytime, and he knows more about daytime, the history of daytime, in purely historical terms, than anybody I've ever met. I think Doug Marlin would be amazed, you know.
I think so,
frankly.
Too.
Oh, no, well, you're not the only one. So my mother's been saying that I should have done this when I was 16. So she's been
and
telling me that for 30 years.
And so how's the project coming along? Am I going to have to kick your ass when I get to New York in 2 weeks?
Yeah, probably.
No, I can't say, you know, the talent and the creativity. I also have to say, Mia Sierfo. What happened?
Oh, no, I'm still here.
Oh, can you hear me?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
It was, Mia Sierra, who just did the whole, the things that were really, it's like she put a whole thing together to the song Smile. And she edited a series of pictures all through my career. Well, another one is Shilpa, you know, Patel, who will edit these collages together. And you stop and you sit down and you think, wow. And if you're an asshole, you think, wow, I must really be something. For these. But if you had any sense at all, my response is, I have a great sense of humility. It's like, what the hell did I ever deserve? I mean, it's an outpouring of creativity. You know what I mean? I mean, it's talent, creativity, the time that it takes. It is
right.
Just such an, I can't say enough about it. It's just, it's very, very moving. I said, when he sent me the beginning and the end of Mitch, I said, damn it, Terry, you got me crying.
Aww.
Terry, girl. Like, what have you done? You just destroyed me with this thing. It's sort of like, I call it home movies, only better lighting. You know?
Right.
Exactly.
This is your life.
That's right. That's mm-hmm. right. But they're invaluable documents. And believe me, it has done so much for me in terms of keeping work that people might have forgotten. I certainly have forgotten. You know, so,
right.
Before my, I hate the word fans, before people who have followed my career. You know, I mean, fan, that's an inanimate object that stirs air. You know what I mean? That's
okay.
Why I refuse to take my page to a public page or a fan page. I keep it a private page. It limits me at 5,000, and then everybody
right.
has, I think I have, what do I have now, Terry? 1,500? They call it followers. See, I don't even like that. They used to call it subscribers. I don't like followers. Followers is somehow, to me, subscribers is my... It's like, I don't want to say to someone, yeah, my list is full, but you can follow me.
Yeah.
I would rather say, but that you can subscribe to my page. See, that's more, it's just more respectful. You know what I mean? Anyway, I digress. Terry, what's
yeah.
up?
Nothing much. There was one question I wanted to ask.
Okay, I'll shut up.
Oh, no, because, people have sent me, stuff, but posted on my page, you know, are you coming to New York Comic Con? And I'm like, I don't know. I have to ask them.
New York Comic Con is the one in Lower Manhattan, and when is it?
I think it's in sometime in October.
Yes. I believe the answer to that question is yes. I'm working with my good friend, again, Eric Nienhuis, who is involved in a reality show of his own, and he's got 50 million projects going, and he is also involved in the film Sensory Perception that I'll do my first day of shooting on the 25th in New York. And as a result of that, I'll be in the area, so I'll be at Connecticut Comic-Con on the 26th. And I believe that he has been talking to the people, and although, you know, we've been busy getting the contract details and the deal memo for Sensory Perception so that, and, the, you know, things that are, because I'm going to be on a plane out of Atlanta a week from Friday. And I won't effectively be living here anymore. And I've lived here for the last couple of years because my family's here. And so we haven't really talked about it. But I believe he has worked it out so that I will be there. Is that the one that has Artists Alley?
I think so.
Then I believe I am going to be there.
Yeah, it's in the Javits Center.
I think so. Yeah, and if that's true, and as soon as that gets finalized, of course, I'll be on their website. But I believe the answer to that question is yes. They have approached me, and I handed it off to Eric, and I think he's finalizing that, yeah.
Okay, yeah, because that's basically the one question I had.
Yeah, I think so.
Him.
I think so.
Okay.
Well, Terry, thank you so much for calling in. And again, like I thanked you earlier about the videos. It was a treasure for me to sit there. And I just initially went to watch a few different things and ended up watching, I don't even know how many of them. I just know I was, you know, on there till like 3 in the morning watching this stuff.
I know, it's true. And yeah. Terry, so, you know, Good Enough to Eat, you know, this is one of my, like, favorite restaurants on Amsterdam Avenue, to go and have these yummy waffles and orange butter and this thick chicory smoked bacon and eggs. So I'm going to drag you to Good Enough to Eat, you know, in a couple of weeks when I get there, all right?
Okay. Well, I have a restaurant for you to go to, too.
Okay, oh, excellent. Sounds good.
Oh,
you know,
okay.
I love to eat.
All right.
Okay, buddy. Thanks for calling.
All right, bye.
Thanks, Terry.
Right.
Bye. Bye-bye.
Thanks, Terry.
Okay, yeah. We'll pick up the other call. Oh, wait, if it stops moving. There we go. Dave, you're live on the air.
Hey, Pam, it's Dave Cable One. Thank you for following me, or doing the fan follow every Friday. I appreciate that.
Oh, you're welcome. It's my pleasure.
And I appreciate it so much. I'm so bad at that. And Mr. John Wesley Shipp asked me to call into the show tonight or listen to it or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
John, last night I said something about, like, Carter Jones versus...
Oh, you're the guy. I talked about you earlier in the broadcast. Yeah, you mean on Facebook. You said something about Carter Jones... Oh, yeah, I certainly did. I said I'm all analyzed out. That was like 1 o'clock this morning. But that's
exactly
a perceptive question. And you asked me the difference between Carter. I have to take a moment here and brag on the writers and brag on Felicia Baer, brag on myself to say that Carter Jones is, as far as I know, so far the only character that's ever served as the basis for an academic paper. I forget which university, at one of our leading universities, about the whole abusive, incredibly abusive character Carter Jones was of women, and yet the appeal that the character had for the audience, and it served the basis for a thesis, graduate thesis, at one of our leading universities. I'm very proud of that, but meaning it had, you know, weight, depth, and substance. But I touched on that earlier. David, right?
Yes.
I touched on it a little bit earlier in the program tonight. I said, there's like a creative divide. You know, it's like Carter Jones and Douglas Cummings were on one side of the divide, and that was, you know, they had a deep wound. They were. I could really connect with them on a human level, and play a sense of, you know, and it was just a completely different approach. Use everything that I had ever learned in an acting class, substitutions, truth of the moment, you know, private moments, you know, recreating a real emotional experience. When I got to Eddie Ford, it was like the only thing I know is to run straight at this. This guy is just so dark. And I don't think it was supposed to last as long as he did. He was supposed to come in, be a plot device, lead to a trial, but...
Right.
I sort of found these little openings, and I thought, you know, if I don't give this guy a dark sense of humor and make him offbeat and wacky, he won't last a month because it'll be so unpleasant. So, as like I said, Susan Gammy, the college designer, let me know. Yeah, she let me know right away that her image of John, it's another day at the circus, and I thought, that's it, there it is. And I just kind of went in, and I threw everything I knew about acting out the window, and I just said, you know what? I'm going to say anything that comes into my head. You know, if I want to throw myself backwards over the sofa and start doing sit-ups in the middle of the scene, which I do, in the middle of the hooker scene with Bobby,
uh-huh.
I'm going to do it. You know, and I'm like upside down saying, you know, I mean, if you want to get yourself attached to somebody, then I wish you luck. Because you're going to need it. You know, I'm doing sit-ups upside down, up the back. You know, it was like another day at the circus was the perfect image, you know. And so it was more, it's like I said, more, okay, maybe it was more vaudeville than it was acting. But I have to say, I still go back and I watch those tapes. Maybe because I didn't. Well, maybe it's because I'm just older as an actor, and it used to be that there was so much at stake with every part that I did. There was so much of my self-worth. I'll never forget Jane Elliott. We all know Jane Elliott.
Oh, we love Jane Elliott.
Quartermain, General Hospital. She did the movies with Elvis Presley. When I won my first Emmy, she had already won. She came on to Guiding Light, as we know, and played that wonderful split character storyline.
Yes.
Good friend of Doug Moreland. And after I won my first Emmy, Jane said, well, now you've won your Emmy. You have nothing else to prove. You can just have fun. That was
a great
thing to say, but I didn't get it. I didn't get it. I didn't get it until 2010. Eddie Ford. I didn't get it to like, oh, you know, I'm a slow learner. I didn't get it to like, oh, a quarter of a century after she said it. You know what I mean? So, but that kind of was Eddie Ford. I was like, you know, I'm not going to worry, you know, if someone in an acting class, I have to say one thing about, and this goes to, partly to your question. I really tried so hard to invest, because I knew I'd been given so much in the Douglas Cummings story. And I thought, okay, the guy's from Texas. Okay, I'm going to be in a sterile studio. Okay, I'm going to need some sense memory recall, you know. I had worked with John Sarno, who had lived with Lee Strasberg the last 7 years of Lee Strasberg's life on sense memory and digging and getting down to some places that I knew that as an actor I'd never been before. I thought, okay, I need a lonely, haunting feeling that I can go to in the midst of sterile air conditioning and a soundstage after a 12-hour day. So I thought about that little road in between Texas along the Rio Grande that went through all these little towns, that, you know, that the proverbial sagebrush blowing through the town that the railroad no longer goes through, and that the building that had been painted over so many times, and now the painting was peeling off and revealing that it's been a dance studio, an apothecary, a department, you know what I mean, and was now abandoned. And I just drove this lonely, lonely road through these little towns, and I said, you know, I want to stay in these little cinder blocks. There's got to be neon light. I got to have neon, like green neon light and one-story cinder block and these lonely towns and these feelings. So I did all of that stuff, you know, to support the character. And it paid off, you know, in terms of a sense of truth. And by the time I got to Eddie Ford, I was like, you know what? I'm just going to have fun. And I managed to do that up until the point when it got so sick. In fact, Hillary, my dear friend, my God, I've loved Hillary Bailey Smith for 20 years. I mean, we were colleagues on As the World Turns.
Mm-hmm.
And,
yeah.
You know, until, you know, by the time I had, you know, my Hillary, you know, tied up, spread eagle, you know, and I was all up in her business, you know, doing all this sick stuff. And the real clinch was when I beat Bobby unconscious.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, yeah.
And then Hillary and I, right after that, did a whole day. And I even said, I said, at one point I was doing all these things. I said, oh, my God, this was right. I said, this woman whom I have loved for 20 years, at the end of this day, is never going to speak to me, you know. And at the end of it, after brutalizing each other, because we did all of the Minuteman scenes in one day, there we are, exhausted. You know, she's got, like, rope burns on her wrist. You know, I'm hoarse, and I've been crazy for, like, 12, 14 hours. Walking back to the dressing room with our arms around each other, she said, well, how do you feel? I said, honey, she said, are you sad? Because the story is essentially over. I said, honey, I'm ready to go. I'm ready to go. It's gotten too dark now. All that it had to. I'm not complaining. That was where the story would have started had we not collaborated and added a lot of humor and all the stuff before. But I said, it's so sick now. You know, everything that we did today and me beating my son, my favorite son, unconscious. I said, I'm ready to go. It's starting to make me a little sick. And that reminds me of what Kathy Hayes, who just turned 80, happy birthday, Catherine, said to me after the scene in which Douglas Cummings is curled up on the bed in her arms and crying, and tears are coming out, and the story, and she's treating me, I've totally devolved into a little child. She took me aside, and she said, and I think I said this on Facebook, she took me aside and she said, John, honey, I'm going to say something. I just want to say something to you, and it's because I care about you. She said, you know, if you're going to play characters like this, you're going to have to find a way to protect yourself, or they will make you sick.
Mm-hmm.
And I've never forgotten that. I've never forgotten that. I said, Kathy, well, because, you know, before the climax of that story, I'd moved out of my apartment in Manhattan to a particular location in a motel that had exactly what I was looking for, that I felt would feed the emotional reality. I mean, and had not slept for 2 days. You know what I mean? It's like, you know, and I said, Kathy, I said, first of all, I so appreciate the generosity of this moment. I said, but I don't know any other way to go there except to go there. Well, see, I was able to keep an emotional distance with Eddie, who was always operating on two levels. One was joke around, good guy, jocular, and then he'd stick the knife in.
Yeah.
And relax, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And they so beautifully took that up in Soap Opera Digest. Whoever wrote that review pick of the week, I'm forever indebted to, you know. That the two levels that initially confused the audience. What's up with this guy? He's even unintentionally funny at times. I said, well, that's about the highest compliment you can be paid when you're playing. You know, you know. I said, somebody thinks you're funny and you don't mean to be. You know, and when, you know. But anyway, it, up until the moment when it got that dark, I was able to keep, you know, a little bit of an emotional distance. You know what I mean? But, yeah, they're completely different approaches. It was like two different actors. Plus, back in the old days, we would do an hour a day, and we did it in sequence. So you knew, you know, when I went back to do with the kid who ended up, kid, how disrespectful, the young actor who ended up shooting Eddie Ford, his real name is Eddie. You know,
Eddie Alderson,
Yeah, he said to me, now we're shooting this in February, he said, John, I just shot a scene for a show that's airing in June. I said, you're kidding me. I said, do you have any idea what happens before or what comes after? He said, no. And that's because the budgets had so contracted, we were no longer doing an hour a day. You know, we were doing a collection of scenes per set, and they were being edited together into episodes. The actors had to go up to the audience, and not the audience, the office workers who worked so hard and were so diligent about. And I was up there. I was like, okay, what happened before? What happens after this? Where am I coming from? Where am I going? And everybody in my storyline did that. Okay, we need to know. And they were like, yeah. And they would dig and they'd go in the files and they'd look for outlines. And, you know, but it was a completely and totally different experience. People have asked me, well, which do you like better, you know, stage or TV? I said, you know, the wonderful thing about daytime is you learn in many instances to fly with your first instinct. There's a trap in that, which theater corrects. And that is, you do the same wonderful words night after night after night.
Right.
You keep digging. You keep go deeper and deeper and deeper. Now, as Matt Williams once said, at the end of a year of doing 8 performances a week, there comes a point where you found everything you can find. You know, and you long to have the improvisational quality of, okay, what are we doing today? We're going to twirl fiery batons. Well, you know, tomorrow I may be jumping up and down on a trampoline, you know, metaphorically. It all kind of works together. I don't know. Did I answer your question?
I actually didn't ask the question yet. Well, you answered my question from last night. But,
from last night? Oh, okay. Okay, you have another one. Okay.
obviously, what you said or implied in response to my Facebook message that, you know, you realized that I was a huge fan of yours. And
no, I did not say that.
True.
I did not say that. I don't use the word fan. I said, are you an actor? I said, because I realized that you read my analysis of the road rage stuff, and I said, and getting through all of that stuff implied a certain level of commitment. I would never say to you, I know that you're a big fan of mine. I said, are you a student of acting? That's what I said.
And I am not, but of course you're exactly correct. You removed the words exactly. So I want to say I think I first learned of you when you were Carter Jones on All My Children, which crossed over to Loving. And, you know, I watched your episode Steroid Boy on NYPD Blue, and
of course,
you know, I watched One Night to Live. You know, I have for decades, and of course, I know all of your experience with Eddie, you know, playing Eddie Ford. I've seen, I think, every scene. You know, unless there was like a storm interruption or whatever. But so if I could ask you a question, it would be, as a fan of John Wesley Shipp, who doesn't watch many movies, because, you know, 20 years ago, if I watched everything my 20 favorite actors were on in daytime, you know, I'd be watching 13 Soaps or, you know, whatever.
Right, right, right. Indeed.
Exactly, you know, but as a fan of yours, what of, you know, aside from One Life to Live, Loving, and All My Children, if I were going to watch a couple movies or, you know, a couple episodes, would it be Dawson's Creek, which I never watched, or would it be what movies or whatever, what performances are you most proud of that I could seek out on the various, you know, media things, you know, YouTube?
Well, you could
Google.
Go to the Lincoln Center Library. I think they have a tape of a live performance of Dancing at Lotus by Brian Friel, which I did on Broadway. No, I know what you mean. What's been on television, and what am I most proud of? And other than that would be available. Certainly there were moments in Dawson's, I would say, in terms of writing, that the hurricane episode, which was the third episode of the first season, the full moon episode, where I finally confront the fact that my wife has cheated on me and I break down with my son, that episode, and my final two episodes, which were the second and third episodes, I believe, of the fifth season.
Fifth season. Yes.
Yeah, my last two episodes, the hurricane episode, the full moon episode, would be four of the episodes that I'm most proud of from Dawson's Creek. Now, if we go over to Sicko, I have to say, one of the creepiest things I have ever done was season two, episode two of Teen Wolf last year. Scene with that wonderful British actor, but it's called Shape Shifted is the name of the episode. I just ended up doing a voiceover for another episode in which he's having a horrible flashback in which, among other things, apparently I locked him in an empty refrigerator in the basement when he was misbehaved. I mean, this father, you said, for fans of The Flash and Dawson's Creek, you better get ready, because is a dark and disturbing portrait of an abusive parent, a character that leaves you no other choice but to hate. We were talking about that early. So I'd say season two, episode two of Teen Wolf. And I just did this movie called Golden Shoes, which I get, again, to flip back, because I played a series of sort of really sort of sicko characters there for a while. And then I play a really good president of the United States. Look it up on IMDb. It's called Golden Shoes 2013, and it's Vivica Fox, it's Eric Roberts, it's John Rhys-Davies, it's Montel Williams, and I play the president, a very good, charismatic. I told Laffer, I said, I actually get to look as good as I possibly can again instead of as bad as I possibly can. So I was like, coming after Eddie Ford and Teen Wolf. So I really believe that, and the producers have told me that if and when, you know, I mean, when that gets itself together, it's in post. I can't wait to see it because it just felt so right, you know. And so let me see. And you know the NYPD Blues, which made an impact. I will wake up at 5 in the morning. I'll sit straight up in bed and I'll go, that one. But I can't. That's all I can think of for now.
You know,
for now,
that works. You know, I can search for those
shows. Helen, Mr. Fudge is a beautiful story. If they ever release it on DVD, and also check the Helen, Mr. Fudge website. It's about a man, Edward Fudge, who wrote a book in the 80s called The Fire That Consumes, in which he disproves the concept of hell from the Greek Gospels, from the original Greek, from that, I mean, and created quite a stir. The trajectory of his family matched the trajectory of my family in so many ways. In that movie, I essentially play my grandfather, and Edward Fudge plays my father. I mean, not really, but
right.
There are so many parallels in our family's lives. And I get to play Benny Lee Fudge, who was Edward Fudge's father, and was a radio evangelist, but was this family was astonishingly enlightened when we're talking about the 50s, 60s, 70s, 50s in Alabama, Athens, Alabama, where the story takes place, called Hell and Mr. Fudge. I'm very proud of that performance. Of course, oh my God, I can't believe I have blanked on her name, Young and the Restless. It's right.
I'm sorry, my dog is barking. I'm sorry. Go ahead.
Right on the tip of my tongue. Beautiful woman. She's been on for a while. Oh, my God. She played my wife in Helen, Mr. Fudge. I know her name. I just said it earlier today. Because I always say, you know, we both look 100 years old in the movie, but we were supposed to. But, oh, my God. I can't even believe this. I'm on my computer. Anyway, talk amongst yourselves for a moment, because I am not.
Okay.
I'm not going to humiliate myself.
Eileen Davidson, I found
Thank
it.
You.
Eileen
Thank
Davidson.
You. Eileen, I'm so sorry. I adore Eileen Davidson, and she does wonderful work in that movie. It's beautifully directed. I mean, coming out of Eddie Ford, in which I was like over the top, this director was so wonderful. He kept shaving. It was the perfect role to do. You know, it's like Dancing at Luna's on Broadway was the perfect role to do after running around in a red rubber suit for a season. You know, go legitimize myself in a Tony Award-winning drama. So Helen, Mr. Fudge was the perfect one to do after Eddie Ford because it was simple, it's truthful. The director would come and say, "That's great, John. 10% less. That's good. 20% less." You know. And just so centered me, and it's such a, the whole film is that way. Mackenzie Astin, Carrie Lynn Pratt, you know, Eileen Davidson. I mean, the young boy who plays young Edward Fudge is an actor. Oh, my God. And I have to tell him that his friends, older friend, the sort of, you know, ne'er-do-well guy has been killed. And he has to confront for the first time, is he in hell? Is he in hell? You know, this little actor acts his heart out. I mean, it's a wonderful, wonderful film. If you get a chance, there's a website, Helen, Mr. Fudge. It's in screenings across the country, and eventually they'll release it on DVD. But I'm also very proud of that. I'm very proud of that. I think I've died in just about every project I've done in the last 7 years. Mama said, for God's sake, can't you live in one of them? It's very upsetting watching you die again and again and again and again.
Well, thank you, John, for answering my questions. And, you know, since we are Facebook friends, it is very apparent to me that you are so highly intelligent. So besides your acting and your appearances in different shows, it's evident to me that you have like a severely high IQ, which I respect, you know. And I do read, well, I read everything you write on Facebook.
I'm so sorry. No, I'm here. That was a joke. I'm hearing you, and I'm appreciating what you're saying. I'm sorry.
He's been.
Well, I don't read everything, but it's sort of like when I check in with Facebook, I read everything, you know, that everybody writes, you know, up until the point where my phone rings or something happens. So I miss some things, but I mean, it's apparent besides being a wonderful actor, you know, a phenomenal person, a very intelligent person, and somebody that has entertained me on TV, that, you know, you have a lot to say, and you're a very interesting person, and thank you for accepting my Facebook.
You are welcome, and I enjoy interacting with someone who, I was actually surprised that somebody, because I did get sort of carried away. You know, I'll remember one thing that reminds me of something else, and I'm thinking, you know what, I get that I'm writing this for myself, but every now and then someone will read and get me, and that is very, I often joke and I say, well, that sort of makes me feel that it hasn't all been for nothing after all. You know what I mean? You know,
right.
It's a very nurturing thing to feel like you've been seen and heard. And in the short time I've known you, that's how you've made me feel. And I also have to say that I was also fortunate to have been born into a family. My father, who began, my mom and dad voted for Nixon over Kennedy in 1960, and then in 2008 in California, while it was still legal, he performed as a Baptist minister his first same-gender wedding.
Really?
So that's the trajectory of my family, following their sense of truth. We had 18 bullets flying through our house when I was a freshman in high school because we had a racially integrated, some of our friends were African American that year, and so we invited them to the parsonage to our party, and we got a shotgun blaster, and it denounced on television by Jesse Helms. You know, they blamed my dad for upsetting the people in the community. He was fired from his church, and the Southern Baptist Convention turned its back on dad. You know, we were the only reason way we survived for the rest of his education were the generosity and the invitations of African American churches throughout the South to come and tell the story. And then 30 years later, I was invited back to the now fully integrated school to give the keynote address to tell what happened and then to tie it together with acts of violence and make observations, which I was very privileged to do. And there was a public apology, and my mom was given a key to the city. This happened while I was doing Dawson. But I have reaped the benefits of having highly intelligent, very progressive. You know, my dad followed his truth and his education wherever it led, even when it led places he didn't necessarily ever anticipate or dream of going. But that's their level of integrity, you know. In the movie, Edward Fudge keeps saying, his father keeps saying, you know, his version of that is, if the Bible teaches us it's true, it doesn't matter if the whole world is against it. The trick is finding out what it really says, you know, not what mainstream religion has taught us that it says, but finding out what it really, without going too heavy, what did Jesus of Nazareth actually do and say the most about while he was alive, you know, and to follow that truth wherever your truth leads you. So I've reaped the benefits of having been born into a family of questers. They're on a quest. My parents have been on a quest their entire life following their truth. And I have reaped the benefit of that perspective. So thank you. And a lot of the thanks goes to them and my brother Karen, my brother Bryant and my sister Karen. So thank you for those comments. I really take them to heart. Thank you.
You're welcome, and I respect you for, you know, I respect you for that. You say what you mean, you know, and that's what it's all about, you know. And John, thank you for letting me speak with you, and you know, Pam, and everybody here. There are probably other callers waiting, but thank you so much. And this call meant a lot to me. Thank you.
Save it, and I'll see you on Facebook.
Sounds good.
Thank you so much for calling in, Dave, and we'll see you on Twitter.
Yeah, we will.
Yes.
You take care of yourself. Well, John, we've just about hit the two-hour mark.
Are we really?
Yeah.
Oh my God. Are your brain bleeding? Are your ears bleeding?
No,
hey, have I?
I've enjoyed every single second, and
yeah.
I'm sure that David has, as well as anybody else that's listening. You know, it's wonderful to take the time to be able to speak with you and walk down your, you know, your memory career lane, and it's just, you know, because we've watched you in so many things, and just to be able to talk to you about it and get your
yeah.
input on it, that means a lot to everybody that is your admirer. I won't say your fan, okay? Your admirer.
Thank you. I appreciate that. No, I do. And I appreciate the forum and the interest, you know. It's like sometimes I think, you know, there's this line in, again, we'll go back to Sondheim to complete it. There's a line at which Mandy Patinkin sings, I've nothing to say. Nothing hasn't already been said. And so when you're presented, or when I'm presented with an opportunity and as much time and patience as you show and interest, you know, it's also good for me. I feel heard and seen. So thank you, David, and thank you, Pam.
You're very welcome.
You're very welcome.
And we will keep in touch with you, and we look forward to seeing much more from you, because I know you have it in you. You're not done yet. You haven't been killed the last kill.
The characters may be dying right and left, but John Wesley is still kicking.
And
I'm looking forward
to seeing Golden Shoes. I want to see
yes.
I can't wait to see it.
Thank you so much. Yes, Lance, the director, and Norm Koza, the producers, I appreciate you. Thank you for mentioning that. Thank you.
You're very welcome. And keep in touch with me. You know, you got my phone number anytime. I'm up
yeah.
all hours of the night.
All right. Thank you. You better be careful what you ask
yeah.
for. Also,
I got
I'm back to
Facebook.
New York, guys, and you have my phone number. This has been my phone number for a long time. So
uh-huh.
I don't know where you. I don't even know where you are. But if you get near Manhattan, give me a call. We'll go have a cup of coffee.
David, you're where is what's the name of your town?
I'm west of Schenectady, so I could. Yeah.
I'm not exactly sure where that is, but you have my phone number. I had a house in Woodstock for years. I lived in Manhattan for 14 years. I'm looking forward to getting back there. Certainly am. But anyway, I don't want to keep you guys.
Right.
I promise I'll listen. The next time we get together, it'll be my turn to listen, okay?
No, you just keep being who you are.
Yeah, because we appreciate that.
Right.
Thanks, David.
Alrighty. Well, you take care of yourself and have fun with your next movie, and we'll chat again soon.
Thanks again, Pam. Good night, David. Good night, Pam.
Good night.
Good night.
Bye-bye. Bye. Well, thank you to Terry also and Dave for calling in. It was wonderful to hear from other people, you know, and be able to have them call in and talk with John. John's amazing. John has so much energy. I wish I could just bottle up an iota of that and use it.
I know it. He's chock full.
Right?
And he's chock full of information. I love listening to him because he goes out in different tangents.
I know.
But then he'll come back.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah, he does. He just, like he said, one thing reminds him of another thing, and then he'll start talking about that, and then he'll be back to, wait, what was I talking about? He's just done so much, and he's lived his life, I think, to the fullest. And that is what everybody should do.
That's true.
So, well, thank you so much to our listeners for joining us today. I hope you stuck it out for the 2 hours because it was wonderful. It was phenomenal. I'm so happy that this is on podcast because, you know, you can go back and listen anytime to his stories. And speaking of which, if you do want to listen to this podcast again or any of the previous ones, you can do that on my website at take2radio.com. on iTunes for free and also on Stitcher for free. Stitcher's a mobile app that you can download to any of your mobile devices. And give us a shout-out, a follow on Twitter at Take Two Radio. And then David and my other co-host, Sabina, you can follow them at Take Two Radio Crew. This is all with the number two, by the way. And follow us on Blog Talk. They'll send you an email each and every time we have a guest scheduled. And speaking of guests, our next guest will be on August 20th. And we're going to have Cassidy McMillan. I'm sorry, I almost said her name the wrong way. McMillan. And she has written a documentary on bullying and bully side. And she's going to have a Kickstarter project about that. And if you get a chance, check out the documentary. She has a part of it on her website, and it's bulliesandfriends.com. I do tweet it out nightly, and hope you'll follow them on Twitter also, at Bullies and Friends. It's a very serious issue in society today, and the more people that, you know, do these types of documentaries and go around to the schools and talk to the kids, either the ones that are the bullies or the ones that are being bullied, will help save a lot more lives, and there won't be as many suicides. So I highly recommend that you check that out, and we will be speaking with her on August 20th at 7 p.m. Eastern Time. So I do hope that you'll join us. And with that, I'm going to say thank you, David, for joining me again tonight. We didn't get to say too much, but that's okay. He did our work for us.
That's true.
And he's definitely more interesting than I am, so.
Well, you should do a movie, and then maybe we'll be that interesting.
Yeah, right. I don't think that's going to happen. But anyways, we do have some more upcoming guests that we have confirmed, some that we're waiting on, and just watch the website, watch Twitter, watch Facebook. I have a Facebook page for Take Two Radio as well. And we will update you as they come along. And take care, everybody. Enjoy the rest of your evening, and God bless each and every one of you. Good night, David.
Good night, Pam. Good night, everyone.
All right.
God bless.
Bye-bye.
Bye.